Bookstack with Richard Aldous, the Books and Ideas podcast brought to you by AmericanPurpose.com. Coming up on the show today, Paul Sturavin, author of the new book, Putin's Exiles, Their Fight for a Better Russia. Paul, welcome to Bookstack.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And congratulations on the new book. So who are Putin's exiles?
So in the main, they are the people, as many as a million, that left at some point following the all-out invasion of Ukraine by Putin and Russia's army in February of 2022. Putin has been in power now for nearly a quarter century, and there have been people who, you know, previously left for political reasons largely, but you had an enormous number leaving after the invasion, some because, you know, they were already on a list, they thought, of sort of anti-Putin type people, and they were being, you know, they just did not want to stay, also of conscience. Others, they wanted to avoid conscription, so they just, you know, they got out. So now we have a diaspora that's probably about a million people.
And of course, the immediate context for this is the death of the most prominent critic, Alexei Navalny, that kind of internal exile, plus the sham elections of this past weekend saw Vladimir Putin, I use this word advisedly, re-elected. How have these events changed the calculations in terms of the exiles?
So I think in two ways. I mean, the Navalny death, although it was not really a surprise in some sense, was still a shock. I mean, you know, he had been recently transported to a remote penal colony in the Arctic North. He's 47 years old. I mean, no particular reason to think he could not, you know, live even under confinement for many years. Suddenly he's dead. And the, you know, the answer to that question is why. And it seems like it's some form of a kind of state directed murder, which took place, if not immediately before he died, at least the act that would lead to his death sometime before. But in any case, widely blamed on the state and on Putin. So I think among many exiles, a sense of this shock followed by demoralization. And, you know, our leader, the really undisputed leader, the most charismatic of the opposition figures, no longer with us. Unclear whether his widow, Yulia Navalny, could take over for him. She really has not been in that role. At the same time, I think there's quite a bit of anger and resistance that can take a more hardened form. So what I'm watching for are increased signs of militancy on the part of exiles. They won't be in the greatest of numbers in terms of people who are simply, you know, resisting through agitation or peaceful means, but there will be some more who will take up the gun. I'm convinced of that. And it's an old story in Russia. I mean, the wheel of Russian history never stops turning. Recently, I've been reading about 19th century Russian revolutionaries, a group, for example, called Narodnaya Volya, the People's Will, who assassinated the Tsar in 1881. So I think this edge now will come back in sharpened form.
Yeah, I was very struck by that, actually, reading the book. You talk about the importance of history and make the point that in terms of exiles returning to Russia, overthrowing a regime, there's an obvious precedent in Lenin and the Russian Revolution. But on the counter to that is that the exiles during the Cold War were mostly ineffective, and change then really came from the internal contradictions of the system itself and from reformers trying to change the system. What do those two somewhat contradictory lessons of history tell us, do you think?
Well, I think they're kind of a mirror of the fragmented and contradictory nature of Russian society and history. I largely agree with you, although I think there are some caveats. I mean, a figure like Alexander Solzhenitsyn, for example, who went into exile and was, of course, a literary figure above all, but with a political message, I think he did have an influence from his exile in the, you know, the Russia-like woods of Vermont. So there were figures like that. The notable example of sort of futility in exile was among the so-called whites who left after the Russian Civil War was concluded on terms that left the Bolsheviks in power. And they went into exile, and they really just ended up kind of dissipating their days drinking, you know, tea from the porcelain china with the czar's, you know, stamp emblazoned on it. I mean, that's kind of one picture of exile. People like Nabokov, you know, wrote, you know, beautifully about this kind of wasted or unhappy days that one pines for Russia in some sense, but one doesn't want to go back because it's dangerous. So that's another distinctive quality, I mean, I think, among the exiles. I think language is really quite important. The Russian language is really not spoken in all that many places outside of Russia. And in some places, like in Ukraine, where, you know, you may not find yourself among companionable people happy to see you. So the exiles outside of Russia in this diaspora are largely amongst themselves. So many of them are missing Russia. Many of them would like to do something that's effective. Many of them are looking just for gainful employment and protection of their residency status. So it's quite a mixed and, you know, motley crew here.
And you talk about those figures drinking tea from the porcelain teacups, and you know, we immediately think of those John le Carré novels like Smiley's People. But it's one of the things that I really like about this book is that so often we immediately start talking about the politics and the strategy and all of that, and we forget that these are actually personal stories. And one of the things that is striking about the book is the poignancy of many of the conversations that you had with these kind of characters, that it's not just about the politics. These are real people in exile missing their homeland.
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, I'm a lover of Russian literature. I think my kind of Russia bug began in my teenage years with Dostoevsky and Crime and Punishment, which is one of the more easily digestible of his works. And, you know, for a middle-class kid growing up in suburban central Massachusetts, this was quite an exotic world and a very appealing one in a way, which seemed to have such wide human boundaries. So one of the reasons I wanted to write this book was because I thought, I wasn't sure quite what I would find, but just as a sponge, I would absorb, I would meet people who in their roundedness and would be interesting and appealing to me. And why were they there? You know, because this was an existential choice that they had to face. So yeah, one such story is of a young woman, Nastya, who I met in Yerevan, the capital of Armenia, and she had fled. She was a medical student. She was studying neurology. Her mother, she had grown up in this village in northwestern Russia near Finland, and her mother had always told her, you know, stay away from politics if you know what's good for you. So she refused all through her institute years to participate. Some of her friends got expelled from the institute for participating in anti-Putin politics. But finally, the war comes, and it's too much for her and her conscience, and she flees. So we find her in Yerevan, and she, you know, over dinner, she kind of somewhat tearfully tells me her story. I mean, she came out as an anti-Putin protester in the streets of Yerevan. Her mother, actually, back in Russia, saw her on film on Russian TV that had filmed the protest, screamed at her. I mean, you know, this, you can just imagine, what are you doing to yourself? And they made up, but, you know, this kind of generational divide, which I think is also age old in Russia, came across to me, and this sense of guilt too, and a need to, or a desire to repent, which is very Dostoevsky. And Nastya was studying the Ukrainian language. Her dream was to go to Ukraine after the war and help to restore it. So, you know, that kind of a story, which is, you know, probably about as dramatic an arc as I encountered, it does grab one. It is beyond politics, although politics is part of it, but it's very much, you know, this is what I am choosing to do with my life.
And there's another interesting dimension, it seems to me, which again you bring out in the book, that many of those who are living overseas, who have left Russia and are missing Russia, also find themselves subjected to abuse for being Russian in those other countries, and find Russian culture, for example, listening to Tchaikovsky or reading Dostoevsky and this kind of thing, will often find themselves denigrated for doing so.
Well, absolutely. I do not believe, as I was told on my trip to Ukraine last year, that Chekhov, you know, belongs to the Russians and should be avoided. No, you know, Chekhov, whose portrait is in part of my Zoom wallpaper, belongs to everyone. He belongs to the world. He belongs to any reader in any country, in any language, if you can get the right translation. So I deeply believe that the Russians are being otherized in some fashion, particularly in Eastern European countries that have, understandably, a long history of rancor and tension with Russia. But nevertheless, I think we should learn our lessons from history, that we do not simply erase or put a black mark on an entire group of people. Different Russians have made different choices. There are 140 or so million people in the Russian Federation. There are many more Russian speakers in not more than 140 million, but millions more outside of Russia. And they don't all believe in the same things. Some of them, I think, are quite worthy of our support.
One of the other things that you point out is that many of the Russians in exile are young. And so in that sense, the rebellion or their resistance will inevitably outlast Vladimir Putin. And it's one of the reasons why you say, and you do say it tentatively, that the book is actually an optimistic one. It's not necessarily one that is cast down in doom and despair.
No, I want to be optimistic. It's not that I want to have, you know, glassy eyes or rose-colored, you know, that sort of thing. But one wants to look through the lens with some hope, which I think in this case is warranted, partly because, as you say, for the generational reasons, which again is just such an old story in Russia. I mean, Turgenev's Fathers and Sons, which actually in Russian is Deti, children, and he wasn't only talking really, you know, about the sons. So this idea of the generational change, many of these anti-Putin people, though not all of them, are of a younger generation. They have a slogan, Paka Putin Jiv, while Putin lives. While Putin lives, they will not go back to Russia. But Putin is 71 years old, and yes, he's been reelected, and yes, you know, he'll be essentially czar for life, should he choose. But people will outlast him, and this is a long game. The more savvy among them, I think Navalny certainly understood that this would take a while to play out. So we haven't seen the end game now for, you know, what happens with the post-Putin Russia. And one of the arguments I make, and this is also a reason for optimism, is that it's really only in exile can you preserve a kind of vision of Russia, a good vision that is at odds with the sort of autocracy and the reality that we now see on the ground in Russia. The government, the regime, will not let you have such a vision, and the media cannot articulate that vision inside of Russia. The cultural flower of the country has left. So it has to come from outside of Russia, but also from Russians looking back in. And again, it's an old story. Alexander Herzen, who, you know, the bell in the 19th century, one of the great reformers of Russia against serfdom and so forth, he was doing all of his work, you know, in exile.
Yeah, I mean, you've mentioned many of these continuities with Russian history. And one thing that I was particularly struck by, and to be honest, didn't know very much about, was the importance of the Russian Orthodox Church here. That, you know, we know about the patriarch who supported the war and has been an ally of Vladimir Putin.
Yes,
what I didn't know was that many of the dissidents, most prominent dissidents and important dissidents, are Russian Orthodox, and they have been very effective and very vocal in their opposition, not just to the president, but also to the role of the church in Russia today.
Yeah. I mean, I think the Russian Orthodox Church is one of the more misunderstood institutions in the West, because, I mean, it is very opaque and it's hard to understand. And we're familiar with, you know, Roman Catholicism and the Pope and so forth. It's really not like that. I mean, Russian Orthodox Church, they have families, they're permitted to marry. It's just a very different kind of an animal. Yes, they have a patriarch who's in Moscow, but there's also this kind of populist tradition within the church, which, you know, I lived and worked in Moscow nearly 25 years ago, and I went to a monastery over an Orthodox Christmas and met a so-called starets, wise man elder, who is chosen by the people, you know, the believers. They have their own way of doing things, which also we see from Russian history. Dostoevsky liked to write about that. So nowadays we do see dissident priests. I met with one in Batumi in Georgia on the shores of the Black Sea, who had a prime position preaching, sermonizing from paces from the Kremlin at his church. And yet he left after the war, and he's, you know, outspoken in his way. And there are others. They would like, I think there are silent dissidents in Russia among the priests, even up to the level of the bishops, I have been told. So, yes, I mean, they are part of this fabric. Sadly, and this is also characteristic of exile communities, they often are not communicating with each other, you know, the dissident priests and the more secular aspects of the Russian opposition. It's rather fragmented.
I mean, you mentioned the silent voices there. You do include the voice of many of those who've stayed. And of course, Navalny would have been the most famous example of somebody who was an internal exile. But some have argued that, you know, the exiles who have left have actually strengthened Putin's hand by leaving, that their actions are in effect abandonment, because it means there is no effective opposition in Russia because so many of those dissident voices are no longer there. Do you think that's a fair characterization, or just doesn't simply recognize the reality of what's going on?
I think it's understandable that some would hold that perspective, but I think for the most part, it doesn't recognize the reality. Because as we just saw in this most recent election, there was not even a particularly strident voice. It's Boris Nadezhdin, whose last name in Russian is sort of a root of hope, who was gathering signatures just to be on the ballot. And he was anti-war, and he got over 100,000 signatures. I'm told he may have gotten as many as 200,000. And these among people who, when they sign, they're giving their identities over to say he should be on the ballot. So that was a brave act himself. And he was expelled from the ballot. So really, you know, and look at the media. You can be charged by the process. If I were to go on a public square in Russia someplace far from Moscow, or really anywhere, with a balloon in the colors of the Ukrainian flag, you know, the blue and the cornflow yellow, I would be detained, you know, prosecuted, possibly charged. I mean, there's no tolerance for dissent. So in what has become effectively a police state, how does one, you know, have one's voice heard? I think if had those people stayed, they would have been, you know, the victims of a crackdown. And I think they're doing the best they can from outside of Russia for the reasons we've talked about in articulating a vision beyond Putin and making their voices heard. And some of them, as I say, taking up the gun. There's a Free Russia Legion fighting now in Ukraine that recently conducted a border raid. You know, I talked to these people on WhatsApp. You know, I'm in Russia, one told me the other day. And it's kind of like, okay, you know, we're not sure what their strength in numbers is, but nevertheless, it's somewhat symbolic. But there is this vigorous, and again, I think increasingly militant opposition to Putin.
And, you know, talking of taking up the gun, most of the exiles that you talk about and that we tend to think about are those who want a more liberal Russia. But as we saw with Prigozhin, there is also a flank to the right. What's the status of that at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think Prigozhin is in a kind of strange and idiosyncratic category. I mean, he was an ally and associate of Putin in a way. Then he broke from him. He oversaw a band of mercenaries, basically. I mean, they had, you know, all kinds of revenue-raising schemes in Africa and places like that, who ended up fighting in Ukraine, yes, on behalf of the, you know, the Russian cause in Ukraine. But there are others who are right-wing nationalists who have their own reasons for not liking Putin, who have also taken up the gun. So not all of these people are of a what we think of as a kind of Western liberal stripe. I mean, you get a lot of different flavors when you get to these people, and particularly among extremists. I mean, taking up the gun is a, you know, it's a pretty radical act. So they are not all going to be sort of Thomas Jefferson, you know, believers in small d democracy. What unites them is a desire to topple Putin.
In the past, with these kind of elections with Vladimir Putin, we've tended to think about what is going on in terms of Russia itself. This election, however, has clear implications for Europe, that Putin is a threat to Europe, to NATO, to the balance of power globally as well. Where are we, do you think, in those kind of terms? And what do you predict for Russia's relationship, particularly with Europe?
Well, I think it's really quite fluid and a work in progress, because I don't think that Europe, and I would also include America, have quite known how to respond. The sanctions regime has really not worked as intended. And, you know, Russia's economy has shifted to a war footing, and it has found many ways to obtain the kinds of products that consumers want from countries outside of Russia, and avoiding, you know, in a sense, evading these sanctions. So that's one part of the political strategy that has not worked. Meanwhile, the military aid effort has somewhat stalled in America for political reasons, the divided Republican Party. And in Europe, they're kind of scrambling to make up for that. There was an interesting story today in the Wall Street Journal about how the Czech Republic actually has become organizing a middleman as a supplier of ammunition to Ukraine. So I think we're in this almost like triage period, and there's no larger strategy. You know, Macron in France just sort of suggested, just hinted the possibility that there might be foot soldiers from NATO countries, European countries in Ukraine, and he got an immediate, you know, pushback. Germany does not seem to want to go there under its current chancellor. So you probably know better than me. The Europeans, they just seem like, you know, there's a desire, but not necessarily a will. So it's a very difficult situation. I'm not sure where we'll be in 6 months to a year.
Yeah, and it's, as you say, the European Union and NATO countries are divided over this. This is also an important year for the broader strategy, obviously, because it's an American election year. It is one of those curious situations whereby Putin invaded Crimea under President Obama and then Ukraine under President Biden, but things were relatively quiet under Donald Trump. It doesn't seem controversial, particularly, to say that relations with Russia would probably be better in a second Trump term. But why that would be so? Obviously, that's the controversial point. What do you see as happening to American strategy in the event of Donald Trump winning the election?
Well, I hate to use the term deep state, because that kind of feeds into Trump's vocabulary. But I think there is a kind of national security state, let's say, if you will, that remains very much on Ukraine's side and wanting to, you know, so whether you're talking about bureaucrats or people at the Pentagon and at the State Department and the Central Intelligence Agency, allies in Congress and so forth, and they can be rather formidable. Trump at the top, I mean, he's such a mercurial person, but I think he does have this weird admiration for Putin like he has for any number of so-called strongmen around the world, even, you know, Xi in China, even though he disagrees with many things that China is doing, well, has to impose tariffs. So it's a little bit hard to predict, except I don't think he'll be much. Trump, I think, will do what he can not to sort of force Russia, you know, in any meaningful way back out of Ukraine, and would be accepting, I think, of any deal that could possibly be reached. But he's kind of inept in making these sorts of deals, despite what he, you know, says about himself. So it's a little bit hard to see how the situation is going to change.
But we do know enough about presidential power that direction from the top can have a profound influence. Reagan in the Cold War is the perfect example of that. And the fact that the Biden administration took on so many of the priorities of the Trump administration on China, on the Middle East, again, is a good example of the way in which he was able to change the calculations. As I say, I don't think it's controversial to say that the US and Russia would have better relations because Putin and Trump seem to have better relations. But as you say, it's the rest of it that seems to me to be a recipe for instability, not just in the United States, but also for NATO, with implications for Ukraine, of course.
Yes, I think you put your finger on it with NATO, because at this point, you know, Trump's return to power would not present the kind of surprise that his initial ascension presented in 2017 when he was inaugurated, and then suddenly this whole NATO question was out there about, you know, are we giving sufficient aid? Are 2% or 3% or whatever of GDP? Is the American president really serious about, you know, wanting to sort of draw the curtain on NATO? All of that will come back. But I think at this point, I mean, I am not in Europe, but I do have the sense that people have at least thought more about this at this point. And there's likely to be a more thought out or coherent response. That would be my guess. NATO is also now larger. I mean, we haven't talked about this, but, you know, you've got an extended border with Russia from Finland and Sweden. So we shouldn't think that everything is too easy for Putin just because he seems to be riding high. You know, this is his so-called reelection and, you know, the way the war is going, the war of attrition in Ukraine that would seem to favor Russia. But I think we'll see. I think we've got some more twists and turns in this drama, and, you know, we don't want to predetermine the outcome or, you know, yes, Trump will make a difference, but I again, we'll see. Also, what will be the composition of the Congress? Should the Democrats take control of the House in Washington, as is possible, then some things might begin to move. Or the Republicans couldn't, you know, take control of the Senate, and then we'll have that equation. So we can have this conversation, if you'd like, after the November elections.
And, you know, I guess that kind of leads me to my final question, Paul, and I hinted at it kind of earlier. You do, at various points at the beginning and the end of the book, talk about a certain optimism, not just in terms of Russia, but in the broader situation as well. You know, if you had to look at the longer term future of Russia, do you still see, even after the events of recent weeks, this kind of more optimistic future, not just for Russia, but even for the broader context?
Well, I mean, I feel like I am committed to the optimistic viewpoint, but I hear you. I mean, you know, in the short run, it's not looking very good, is it? I have, you know, some faith in the idea that Putin is not simply Russia, that that identity is not there, and that Russians are a, you know, if tormented, nevertheless remain a tremendously kind of creative and vibrant people. So that leads me to think that better days can come. I guess my take on Russia is that the change in Russia is just not like change that we're familiar with in the West. It's not a matter of, you know, quadrennial elections or something like that. It's more generational. Change tends to be sudden and convulsive. I mean, how many were predicting the fall of the Soviet Union until, you know, we got the Berlin Wall, and then in a matter of just a few years, it happened. So I think there will be a spring, a primavera, you know, a vesnia for Russia. There will be flowers, but we should maybe not in the nearest of times. You're going to have to wait it out.
Another one of those Russian composers to finish on, Stravinsky and the Rite of Spring. So the book is Putin's Exiles, Their Fight for a Better Russia. It's written by my guest, Paul Starobin, and is published by Columbia Global Reports. But for now, Paul, congratulations again, and thanks for joining us on Bookstack.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Richard.
So that's it from us this week. Don't forget to check our website, AmericanPurpose.com, and to leave us a review on your podcast app. The show is produced by Laura Silverman, and this is me, Richard Alder, saying thanks for listening.